Hello, Lenties and gentlemen of the ADO audience. I'm Spider Robinson, and it's no accident that my name is an anagram for Prods One in Ribs. You've become ensnared in Spider on the Web number 46, a user suppository CAD post being uploaded from a home terminal at the home for the terminally confused, being brought to you, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, put your hands on the radio. Let's get this show on the road. Last night, Jeannie and I went to see Crosby, Stills, and Nash at the Center for the Performing Arts here in Vancouver, along with our dear friends Colin and Andrea McDonald, and a visiting dear friend from Halifax, the man who's been funding Jeannie's Stardance movie out of his own pocket for several years now, Professor John Barnstead of Dalhousie University, who's in town for a conference. It was only CSN's fourth show of this tour, and it was memorable even for them. Three solid hours of magic without a lull. Harmonies like crystal spiderwebs, arrangements like laws of nature working themselves out before your eyes, and the indescribable emotional power that comes from 40 years of having shaped our dreams. Yes, that's how long it's been, 40 years now. If you can possibly catch them on this tour, don't miss it. For a hint of what awaits you if you do, here's how Crosby, Stills, and Nash sounded the last time they passed through this town in 2005.
Thank you!
gonna get down some of that sweet southern weather.
Ironically, when I saw them last night, I had just had my hair cut the night before. By the way, a private message I've been asked to deliver here. The band and road crew would like to send out a hearty and impressed thank you to Watermelon and her old man for the Thunderfuck. And so would I. I haven't seen Watermelon since 2001 in Amsterdam and hope she's well. And without further ado, I'm going to read to you some more from Very Hard Choices, my latest novel, currently available on the stands in Bain Books hardcover in better bookstores everywhere, and mediocre ones in selected locations. If, by the way, this is the first time you've ever run across this podcast and all this is new to you, just go to www.spiderrobinson.com, look for the podcast page where all these things are archived, and go back 4 or 5 podcasts and start from the beginning. I'm taking you now to Chapter 10, Saturday, June 23rd, 2007, Heron Island, British Columbia, Canada. When McKinnon woke up, the bedside clock said it was 12:13 a.m., His watch agreed. He checked. He had set the watch for midnight. He always set his watch when he wanted to wake at a particular time, and never needed to, always waking a minute or so before it could go off. So, basically, he had failed to wake up twice. No, 3 times. The watch alarm repeated after 5 minutes if he didn't switch it off. The fake fire was the only light besides the clock face. The room's overhead light had a dimmer switch, he remembered, but had recently been supplied with one of the new low-wattage fluorescent bulbs, which do not work with a dimmer. He sat up, turned on the bedside lamp, also fluorescent and therefore of only 1 wattage, too bright, and looked around at a room furnished in a style he thought of as quaint misbehavin', with a 50-inch flat-screen TV above a fireplace so realistic he couldn't stop noticing how realistic it was. It took a whole 15 seconds for the flame flicker sequence to repeat, and the accompanying loop of crackle sounds was only 10 seconds long. Genius. He sighed, shut off the fire with a realistic-looking bedside fireplace wall switch, and tried to recall just how he had come to be here in this silly room on this silly island in this silly country on this silly-ass mission. He reviewed the path from birth to here to try and spot just where he had gone wrong. Realized he was reviewing not his history, but that of one of his more memorable cover identities, promised himself to be scared by that just as soon as he had the time, and started over. Born at a rest stop just outside Tampa. Childhood shuttling between warring parents in East Baltimore and Drama City, until he was old enough for acting out to turn into a rap sheet. Very high IQ and reading scores bought him some slack, but 2 years into state college, he graduated to felonies. Vietnam, a way out that didn't involve choices or decisions, until suddenly it did. Chose to live. Months as a shadow company security contractor with a necklace of ears and a price on his head. Recruited into CIA's Operation Phoenix by the Major, a Truman appointee. Under his tutelage, traded necklace and rap sheet for a new name, a new personality, a philosophy, and a purpose. Morphed from wholesale to retail killer. From a soldier who matched himself against other predators with wolfish joy, to a soldier who accomplished exponentially more by passionless assassination of selected civilians or their loved ones. More important, became politically aware on a global scale, and for the first time in his life, truly pledged allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stood. finally too hot to remain in Southeast Asia. Back home to Drama City, which was called Washington when you were wearing a suit and tie and a name with no priors attached to it. 2 years of training, indoctrination, grooming in college, culminating in a B.A. in history, then finally he was ready to do real work, just in time for him to get in on MK Ultra. A long series of events, then, that made leaving a village mayor's dead wife outside their hooch seem like a clean way to make a living. All of them were necessary, all in service to an end that justified any means, truth, justice, and the American way. But all of them were hard just the same. They didn't get any easier, and that was the good news. Felt his allegiance begin to waver. Got himself reassigned to the Funny Farm, the ESP project, as a kind of vacation that he knew would be temporary, and there, to his astonishment, he encountered a man who would change the course of his life even more than the major had. His bladder interrupted his life review, just as he had recapitulated himself to the point of remembering why he didn't have time for this shit. Just as well, probably, the next 40 years would have been dreadful to relive. He shook his head, swung his legs over the side of the bed, and had a disheartening amount of difficulty getting up. On his way to the bathroom, he told himself that perhaps tomorrow would be a little better, and realized he had been doing that for an awful lot of consecutive mornings now. So he passed the time it took for the coffee machine to cycle by working out. He couldn't do his usual morning routine without waking anyone below him or next door, but he did manage enough to get his heart pumping and his joints better oiled. When he was done, he felt 50 again. Over coffee, he started his laptop, confirmed that no one else was using the B&B's Wi-Fi connection, and did some research. The property owner's name was Russell Walker. Mr. Walker was an op-ed columnist with the more liberal of Canada's two conservative newspapers. A widower less than a decade younger than McKinnon himself. An ex-American, no, he saw on closer inspection, a dual citizen who had been born in the U.S. and moved to Canada after, not before, Vietnam, subsequently becoming a Canadian citizen without renouncing U.S. citizenship. Not a lot of those. Shortly, McKinnon found himself wondering if Mr. Walker actually existed. The more he searched, the more skeptical he became. One living family member, a grown son, allegedly living on the opposite end of the continent in the U.S. Organizations belonged to? None. This guy was supposed to be pushing 60 and belonged to no clubs, societies, leagues, guilds, associations, religious groups, political parties, 12-step groups, boards of directors, or porn websites. He paid for the minimum cable package, no specialty or movie TV channels at all. The same cable package also provided barely adequate internet access, slightly better than smoke signals. Max download speed 50 megabytes per second, max upload speed 30, no more than 10 email addresses, and a data transfer limit of 60 gigs a month that his records showed he rarely approached. Phone records showed that the man almost never used his phone, save for short flurries of calls over a 2 or 3 day period every 3 weeks, plus a few holiday and birthday calls a year to the distant son who almost never called back. An odd interval. What actual human activity was on a 3 week cycle? It added to the growing impression that this Walker was a phantom. Wait a minute, the comic strip character, the Phantom, had often used the name Walker as a pseudonym because the Africans he lived among called him the Ghost Who Walks. If a phantom walks in the forest but isn't really there, do the leaves rustle? But the Heron Island Credit Union believed Walker was real enough to give him a mortgage. A mainland bank might have been conned by a Potemkin man, as long as the checks kept clearing. But this rock heap just wasn't big enough. Everyone on it must know each other. So, follow the rest of Walker's money. After the mortgage, his largest expenditures went for, in descending order, food delivery, one quarter from the place McKinnon himself had dined earlier that evening, Colinzi Avernus, and three quarters from the Red Bliss, which appeared to be one of those cooperatives. How were other businesses structured? Anarchy? That sold organic fruits and nuts to the organic nuts and fruits. Prodigious Voltairean quantities of Tanzanian peaberry coffee ordered as beans in bulk by mail from Ontario. Books and CDs purchased from either Amazon.com or one of its associated used dealers. Postage apparently used to mail small quantities of discs and books to others both in Canada and the U.S. There were also regular cash withdrawals at that same irritating interval every 3 weeks, strongly suggesting an illegal drug. But the amounts were such that it was unlikely to be anything interesting. Pot, probably, British Columbia being the connoisseur marijuana mecca for the entire planet. So, basically a guy with no life. Much like McKinnon himself, really, save for the pot addiction. McKinnon got up from the laptop and made another potlet of coffee-colored fluid. As it dripped, he opened a container of butter chicken and ate from it with his fingers. It was symphonic. When the bubbling sound ceased, he washed his hands in the sink, picked up a couplet, looked at it, put it down, and took the whole potlet back to the computer with him. Now, where did Walker's money come from? A lot of it, but not all, came from his op-ed column, it turned out. He seemed to get paid a lot more per column than the other columnists who appear on the same page, though his ran only... McKinnon smiled suddenly. Walker's column, past imperfect future tense, ran every third Friday. The odd three-week interval was explained. So even at his unusually high word rate, he could not be bringing in enough to cover his nut, then. McKinnon kept digging. It was not easy to figure out, but he had special forensic accountancy software designed for that express purpose which was not available to the general or even particular public. Before too long, he understood that Walker's late wife had been a very successful painter who had left enough to cover his needs for the rest of his days, if necessary. But that principle was still untouched because she had also left him an unknown but apparently substantial number of completed paintings. So far, every time his balance began to drop, he had produced one and sold it for enough to keep himself in coffee and CDs for another year or two, a total of four times so far. McKinnon wanted another potlet of coffee, but was out of coffee pucks, save for the decaf, which he took to be a variant spelling of defective. He got a canlet of Coke from the room's micro bar, took that and the butter chicken container back to the desk. He ate a few bites with his fingers, then wiped them off with Kleenex and resumed net searching. Okay, now for the big question. Why was McKinnon studying this ingrown toenail of a man, this hermit who made his living lecturing an entire country about the events of the day? What was his connection to Xandor Zuniniego? The obvious approach was to start with the date Zuniniego had dropped off the planet, find out what Walker had been doing at the time, and then wind both their lives backward until they intersected. Again, he had special software for the purpose, but he never even opened it. Because the very first thing he learned was that on the day Zuniniego had become a ghost who walked 40 years earlier, Walker had been his college roommate. McKinnon must have seen his name in the files many times over the years. It had simply been too bland to stick. He said, "Yes," aloud, punched his thigh, sat back, and resumed eating chicken without consciously noticing it. Bingo! It was confirmed now. His target was alive. And close, too. Until now, he had not been absolutely sure. The cop could have had some innocuous cop reason to inquire after a man 40 years dead over at the far end of another country. But at the first hint of trouble, she had made a beeline for the dead man's old roommate, and then both of them had melted into the scenery. There was no reason to be that paranoid about a 40-year dead guy unless he was not really dead. Case closed. Zuniniego was alive, somewhere in this area. And his two friends were even now making a beeline for Zuniniego to warn him of danger with a head start that widened with each passing minute. Fortunately, his thoughts reached that point before he had absentmindedly finished all the chicken. He wolfed down everything else in the container instead, saving the meat for that damned cat he was going to have to get past. Then he shut his laptop and dressed briskly, pleased that he would be able to keep the beef brisket container sealed and have that for tomorrow's meal. He left in such disciplined haste that he very nearly caught Detective Constable Nika Mandich loitering outside his B&B and drove back to Russell Walker's place at exactly the island's maximum legal speed of 40 kilometers per hour, or in his terms, a low idle. The streetlights ended within what he would have called a couple of blocks, for good, and there was absolutely no other traffic on the road. After a while, he decided he didn't need lights to drive that slowly on empty, moonlit roads, and it would be better to approach Walker's home this late with maximum stealth. So he pulled over for a moment, reached under the dash, and with the small sense of satisfaction he always got from disabling an unwanted safety feature, removed the fuse for his headlights. The road leading to Walker's driveway was a slight upgrade from long habit of caution. McKinnon went a couple of driveways past it at the quietest speed he could, then put it in neutral, shut the engine, and let the car drift back downhill. It rolled slowly enough that even by moonlight he had no difficulty backing into Walker's driveway and coasting far enough to be in shadow from the road. He was nearly at rest when his starboard taillight hit the tree, but still going fast enough to produce a mini whiplash he knew he would feel later, and an absurd amount of crunchy, tinkly noise with an echo. There must be a damn mountain somewhere out there in the dark, though he didn't recall one. He sat still and waited for over a minute, listening for barking dogs, people asking one another where the hell that had been, approaching meteorites. He watched his rearview mirror closely enough to finally detect the approaching cat. He located the container of leftover butter chicken on the floor in front of the passenger seat and got out of the car. He managed to open negotiations with the cat, arrived at mutually agreeable terms, and strike a bargain, but not without difficulty. He was usually good with cats, but this one seemed to be feral. It displayed zero interest in human touch of any kind, but a lively interest in chicken. He gave it all the meat, sealing the bones back up in the container so it wouldn't choke on them. But the moment it finished the last morsel of bird, it made a beeline for the container and announced that it wouldn't mind sampling the gravy, too. He wrapped the bones in Kleenex, dropped them in the car's wastebasket, made sure its windows were sealed. As the cat began following the floppy container around the forest like a drunk chasing his hat, McKinnon took two steps and disappeared, moving through the woods beside Walker's driveway like the shadow cast by a suspicion. Nearly as quietly as the second cat, who materialized in his path about 3 or 4 meters ahead and to the right. No more chicken left. He froze and watched this cat carefully, looking for flattened ears, arched back, or rapid tail movement, and listening for growling, or worse, hissing. It blinked at him for a few seconds, then put its tail straight in the air and came prancing up to see if McKinnon's hand smelled good enough to be scratched by. It did. He got on one knee and gave the new cat about 20 seconds worth of scratching. When he heard the other cat moving somewhere in the woods behind him, he struggled to his feet and continued on his way. He approached the house with extreme care, watchful of alarms, but encountered none. The building was dark inside and out. He circled it to be sure. Nothing brighter than the inevitable standby lights or digital time displays was visible in any window, not so much as a candle. A small outbuilding briefly held his interest because of faint light from its windows, but it turned out to be only an empty office containing a PowerBook laptop with a gaudy screensaver. He checked the door carefully, found it unlocked, and was tempted to slip inside and examine the computer. But he knew he had to confirm that the house was empty first. His shoes were very muddy from walking through wet woods. He doubled back to a hose he'd seen around the side of the house and was able to tip enough water out of it to clean his shoes so they would leave no prints inside. He unhooked from his keyring a mini flashlight the size of the cap on a felt-tip marker and confirmed by touch that it was set for lowest power and smallest aperture. He was not too surprised to find the front door unlocked. He was beginning to get used to Canada. But he was surprised almost to the point of indignation when he learned that it had no lock. Anyone who cared to turn the doorknob could walk in. It made him suspicious enough to dial his mini-flash one step brighter and double-check for a silent alarm, but he found none. He suppressed his irritation and everything else and slipped into the house. He tossed the place slowly, thoroughly, making careful use of his flashlight. Walker clearly lived alone. Every wall of every room except the kitchen and bathrooms seemed to be obscured by tall bookshelves, about a quarter of which held CDs, cassettes, or vinyl records. He had 4 TVs, kitchen, living room, and both bedrooms, but all of them were cheap crap, no flat screens, no big screens even. 2 had attendant VCRs rather than DVD players. Only the set in the master bedroom, a 28-inch tube, had external speakers and just 2 of them. Every piece of furniture and appliance in the house was adequate, but cheap. All the carpets had acne, all the walls needed paint. The sound system in the dining room contained no components less than 10 years old, and some much older. Everything he saw was just good enough for its purpose, with a single exception, an absurdly high-tech Swiss unit in the kitchen that produced single cups of fresh-ground French press-style coffee at the press of a button and cleaned itself afterward. But even that was clearly long past its warranty. McKinnon found himself starting to like Walker. The man treated himself well, but did not waste a dime impressing anyone else. The place reeked of marijuana, but otherwise closely resembled McKinnon's own current apartment in Virginia. He kept up a running search for stashes, hiding places, secret compartments that might conceal clues to Zuniga's whereabouts. There are a million places to stash something in a house, and he knew them all, but found none in this house. The man's marijuana supply, less than an ounce, but strong by the smell of it, was hidden in his fridge in a transparent plastic container. He found signs of abandonment on a moment's notice. A stereo amplifier left on. Thermostat left on day setting. Crumbs on kitchen counters. 3 cups of coffee dregs in the living room. The master bedroom was comfortable and uncluttered, reasonably clean and orderly. The king-size bed was made, and McKinnon confirmed that its sheets and pillowcases had been changed recently. Walker was surprisingly neat and tidy for a widower. This room was where he did most of his TV viewing. It had the largest tube, the only surround speakers in the house, and a fair-sized collection of DVDs and VHS tapes. There was even a tall mirror propped against the far wall at just the right angle to the master bathroom so that Walker could follow a program while sitting on the throne or soaking in the tub. There was a guest suitcase in the guest bedroom, open on the bed but not yet unpacked. The cops? No. Male clothing and ancillaries. Someone who lived and dressed considerably better than Walker. No ID present. The tag on the suitcase handle gave an address in New York City, but no name. The baggage code, too, indicated that the bag had been checked in at LaGuardia in New York. The bathroom across the hall showed no signs of recent use. McKinnon thought about that for a while. Less than an hour after she arrives, Detective Constable Mandich persuades not only Walker, but a newly arrived house guest to join her in dropping everything and running like hell. How? How many people could possibly share the secret of a telepath who had been hiding successfully from McKinnon for 40 years now, and what were the odds of the third one showing up from afar on the very day McKinnon himself finally caught up? He tabled the question and finished his sweep. The only remaining room was used for storage of the sorts of items that would have been in an attic or basement if the house had featured either. He gave it a bored but thorough inspection, finding nothing of interest. He was feeling impatient by then, but forced himself to go through the whole house room by room once more. Only then did he go eagerly back outside to toss Walker's office. It was a glorified shed, perhaps 24 feet by 12, with 3 windows fitted with Venetian blinds. Inside, every inch of wall was obscured by 9-foot-tall bookshelves, all of them full, handmade by some local artisan to accommodate the windows. An old wooden table, covered with a cheap tablecloth, served as a desk, and held a shiny new power book with cable internet, a big cathode tube external monitor, and a pair of lava lights on either side of it, one blue and one clear. On a small wheeled table beside the desk were both a laser printer and a color inkjet printer. They and the power book and the 7-speaker surround sound system connected to it were the most modern and expensive gear McKinnon had seen so far, no more than a year or so old. This was where Walker spent most of his time. He sat down at the keyboard, killed the hypnotic screensaver, opened a browser, accessed a page that was decidedly not part of the World Wide Web, downloaded some software money couldn't buy, and scanned Walker's computer rather more thoroughly than a Vancouver Apple dealer could have. Nothing he turned up was of any use or interest to him, as he had expected going in. He gave some of Walker's op-ed columns a hasty scan and was surprised to find very few stupid opinions. Walker had correctly assessed the significance of 9/11 on September 11th, for example, and had seen through the Iraq bullshit from day one. He had the sense to know and the courage to say in print that Osama had probably been dead for years. The man tended to get his supporting evidence from sources like The Economist, rather than American or Canadian news media. Yet he was not a knee-jerk American basher like many Canadians and nearly all ex-American Canadians. One paragraph in particular caught McKinnon's eye. "America sometimes fails to live up to its own ideals. If you want to say often, I won't argue. So has every nation since history began. But it must be admitted that so far, the United States of America has the most magnificent set of ideals any nation ever failed to live up to." McKinnon was starting to like the man. He hoped it would not be necessary to end him. But his hard drive definitely did not contain the text strings Zandor, Zudenigo, or Smelly with a capital S, or anything else useful. His email contacts included a few names Homeland Security considered questionable, but no more than was reasonable for a national columnist, and none that were flagged red or even amber. He did not have a website. He did not blog or IM or video chat. He had hardly any real friends. Very few of his correspondences produced more than a half dozen exchanges in a year, but he certainly knew some interesting people. His iTunes library ran heavily to jazz, folk, soul, and 60s rock. McKinnon sighed, put the laptop to sleep, left the office, and found himself re-entering the main house without knowing why. From long experience, he knew that meant he had seen something in the house that was not right and failed to consciously notice it at the time. So he let his feet go where they would. He found himself approaching the spare room used for storage of obsolete junk. 5 steps before he reached it, he suddenly remembered what he was going to see that was wrong the moment he passed through that door. A laptop. A Mac PowerBook, but several iterations older than the one in Walker's office, a 1400 series. On one that old, all the connections were in a bay in the back, and playing back memory now, he was certain the only thing connected to this one was its power cord. He had noticed a tiny light on the laptop's lid blinking at him, announcing that it was sleeping rather than shut off. He remembered seeing a blue cable coming in through the wall. It had to be Internet, but was sure it had ended in a coil on the floor, nowhere near the computer. He stopped to think it through. Lots of people kept obsolete old computers around. The new one might break. Maybe a favorite old game would not work with newer operating systems. A power book in sleep mode consumed very little power, so why not keep it plugged in? But even a 1400 could collect and send email, could do simple net surfing, play Internet radio, so why would a man with high-speed Internet access handy choose not to plug it in? Only one answer occurred to McKinnon, and it made him smile. Walker had information on that computer he wanted to be certain could not be hacked, not even by people like McKinnon. It was theoretically possible to encourage a computer through its power cord, but most civilians did not even suspect that, and McKinnon himself could not have done it with the tools at hand, or even had it done on his authorization back when he'd been a company man. He took a moment to marvel at Walker's peculiar form of paranoia. He had taken precautions sufficient to foil a cyber antagonist as powerful and capable as the company itself, or the Mossad, or the late Komitet Gosudarstvenog Bezopeznosti, yet he had taken no precautions at all against a man walking in his front door while he was away. Almost grinning, as he tried to imagine what lovely information he was about to acquire, McKinnon resumed walking and within three steps was in the room and staring directly at the spot where the PowerBook 1400 had been half an hour earlier and was no more. The window was wide open now. Knick-knacks that had been on the sill were scattered on the floor. Someone outside was heading for the trees. Shit! He sprang to the window, grabbed it at either side, and lifted one foot to the sill, and froze there in that off-balance position. The unexpected touch of a gun muzzle between the tendons at the back of his neck was shocking. Worse, he felt it only for the second it took him to identify it. Then it was gone, and now he had no idea where the gun or the person holding it were anymore. He was up against a pro. And his own gun, though covered by his jacket, was holstered at the small of his back. "Good evening, Constable Mandich," he said softly. "May I turn around?" "Detective Constable," came the reply, "and no, you can put your leg back down, then your hands behind your back." He heard handcuffs coming out of a belt holster. "Shit!" He did as directed and waited. The first cuff ratcheted closed around his left wrist. The angle and direction told him she was holding the cuffs with her right hand, the gun with her left. Expected form for a right-hander. He made a fist with his cuffed left hand and punched an imaginary fat man in front of him as fast as hard as he could with it. Instinctively, she kept her grip on the cuffs, which yanked her right side forward, spinning her left side and gun hand away from him. He trapped her right elbow and pivoted sharply to his right, whipping her left arm around in a wide arc that ended abruptly when her wrist smacked against the side of the open window frame. The gun sailed out into the darkness. He was busy then for a while. She was young, strong, fit, and reasonably well trained. But the outcome was never in doubt. He had exponentially more experience. Once she was unconscious, he searched her, found the handcuff key, unlocked the one on his wrist, and cuffed her right wrist to her left ankle. He found a knife there, and unstrapped that, and an empty holdout holster he found on the other ankle. Then, feeling pessimistic, he elbow-crawled to the window and popped up for a quick look. Good news. The one outside had stopped running away, had come back, was a dark silhouette halfway between the tree line and the house. Both hands were free. He'd left the laptop somewhere. He froze when he saw McKinnon's head briefly appear. Walker? Another cop? A neighbor? What difference did it make? He spoke loudly enough to be sure he was heard, and no louder. "If you do not bring it back intact right now, I will hurt her badly." Silence. No reply. No footsteps either running or slowly approaching. "Do not pretend you don't know what I mean." Still no response. He frowned. "At this moment I have no pressing need to kill either of you. The moment I cripple a cop, that changes fast and for good. Last chance. Get the laptop, hand it up through the window, and then go round the house and come in the front door. Hurry. Otherwise, I start with an elbow. They're actually harder to replace than knees. Not that it'll matter.
Very hard choice.
Oh, really? The voice was surprising, too. Definitely not a cop, but not a columnist pushing 60 either. And definitely bluffing.
Make it quickly.
The sigh was audible.
You win.
Footsteps moved away, then came back.
Come straight to the window,
he called, because who knew whether this guy was aware that there was a handgun loose out there somewhere in the shadows to the right of the window. But the footsteps did come straight to the window, and moments later the laptop appeared in the opening.
Set it down on the sill, he said.
Good. He raised his hand high enough to be seen from outside and pointed to his left. Now go around that way.
But you told me to come in the front door. It's over that way. And now I'm telling you to take the long way around.
Pause.
Whatever.
Footsteps moved away to the left. He took the power book from the windowsill, set it on the floor beside him, located its abandoned power cord, plugged it back in, and stood up. Just as he heard the front door opening at the far end of the house, he saw the open door of the closet in which the cop had hidden to ambush him and decided it might work twice. It did. The moment the other had approached closely enough to see the sprawled form of the policewoman on the floor, he raced heedless into the room and knelt by her side. McKinnon pushed open the closet door, took two measured steps, and knelt behind him. He had his knife to the other's throat just long enough for the fingers of his left hand to find the right spot, then was careful to get the blade out of the way as the man fell. He leaned forward and used his mini-flashlight to confirm that this was not Russell Walker or anyone he knew. The guy was about the same age as the cop, but a pat-down showed he carried no weapon or handcuffs. McKinnon sat back on his heels and sighed. Pity the man hadn't brought a second set of cuffs. He got to his feet, checked his clothing for damage, and dragged his burden down the hallway to the kitchen by one wrist, hoping for a duct tape. He had no trouble locating Walker's tool drawer, but the only tape in it was masking tape, too narrow to be of use. How could a man live without duct tape? But in the adjacent drawer, he found a large roll of Saran plastic wrap. Widowers refrigerated a lot of unfinished portions. He took the roll from its box, brought it into the living room, and rolled out as long a sheet of plastic wrap as he could. Then he dumped his newest acquaintance on it and kept rolling him over until his arms were completely pinned to his sides. He cut it with his knife and sealed it in place with masking tape. Then he twisted another length into plastic rope, bound the other's ankles with it, and used what was left over to haul him back to the spare room by, a task made even easier because he offered less friction wrapped in plastic. When he had them laying side by side, he checked their breathing and pulses carefully, then dismissed them from his mind and eagerly turned his attention to the laptop. It didn't take him any time to find what he was looking for, even though he had no idea what it was. All he needed to do was scan for most recent activity. It turned out that these days, Walker used this power book only for a single purpose. Digging his own grave. There ends the chapter. Jeannie and I were lucky enough last night to be able to introduce her Stardance movie angel, John Barnstead, to the film's composer, the great James Raymond, who currently plays keyboards for Crosby, Stills, and Nash. He is also the keyboardist and chief composer for two of my very favorites of all the superb groups David Crosby has ever been part of, those being Crosby, Nash and the inimitable CPR. James's lyrics just fry me. Here's a track he sings lead on from the second CPR album, Just Like Gravity. Though composer credit on this one is shared by James, CPR's lead guitarist, the great Jeff Pivar, its ace rhythm section Stevie Stanislaw and Andrew Ford, David himself, and his lovely and talented wife, Jan Crosby. Here's James Raymond, Breathless.
And you taste breath. And you know, you try to walk in step and stumble laughing. You hold each other up to stop the fall. You hold each other's eyes like a magnet. And for a moment, time just seems to stall. And you touch hands, and you taste bread, and you watch each other. A bell once struck will ring forever. It just gets louder the closer it is held. Love is a bell. Spirit through the forest, where I alone would surely fear to go. Safely with my hand on your shoulder, somehow it's a thing I just know.
Hard Choices by Spider Robinson, Chapter 11, Saturday, June 23rd, 2007, Coveney Island, British Columbia, Canada.
How could I have been so fucking stupid, Zooty?
My voice sounded like an echo coming back from the far end of a cold, dark cave. His sounded perfectly normal.
You weren't expecting an Agent Pitt to come along out of a past you didn't share.
I was worried about people a fuck of a lot scarier than Agent Pitt.
My ass hurt. I must have sat down too hard. I didn't recall sitting down.
and you assume that if they came, it would be through the net. How else? The only way you could put yourself or Nika or me in jeopardy, as far as you knew, was to allow any wisp of a traceable connection to occur between you and Alan online, and you took steps to make sure there were none. You tell me, how could God himself have physically followed Alan's trail to your house? Even if that monster emailed a friend before he left home to kill us, he himself didn't know where he was going until he got here, and when he did, we killed him. Still, you reasoned intelligently that even if you did become the victim of the first burglary in Heron Island history, any reasonable thief would focus on the expensive, recent model computer with high-speed internet sitting in your office and ignore an obsolete old piece of crap worth $100 tops. At worst, he'd open it and glance through it looking for porn and get bored decrypting files long before he got near anything of interest. You hid the dangerous file well enough to stymie anyone but a Macintosh power user, and they don't tend to become burglars. But God damn it, the precautions you took were more than reasonable. This is an unreasonable situation. The sooner you get over blaming yourself, the quicker we can get to work on it. Work on what? You've convinced me Agent Pitt is James Bond on steroids. Well, no way in the world is he going to walk past a superfluous laptop with its sleep light blinking, especially one disconnected from the net 2 meters from an internet connection. No way in the world is he going to have the slightest trouble decrypting old disk doubler encryption, for Christ's sake. How long will it take him to try the date of Susan's death as my password? Third try, tops? It being half an hour later, Max, he will have you and me by the balls and Nika by the ovaries. That is not necessary. It's all there, Zooty, all of it. As close as I could make it to how it actually happened. Everything we did, everything we didn't do, chock full of verifiable facts. The exact spot we buried the son of a bitch, for example. Put it all together, you've got the single most supernaturally stupid thing anybody could possibly have done. I wrote a detailed confession of murder. You're a writer, Russell. It's what you do. It's how you manage to cope with the world by putting it on paper where it's at arm's length. It's how you cope with the most traumatic thing that ever happened to you. Yeah, and left it lying around unlocked in a building I knew the CIA would be inspecting soon. Which you were leaving at high speed, scared to death for your son, not to mention yourself. A man's supposed to have brains even when he's scared, especially when he's scared. Which man?
Huh?
Ow!
He had grabbed me by the ears, hard. He was at arm's length on his knees. A big, nearly naked, pale, hairless walrus with a face reminiscent of Tony Soprano as a fat child.
Listen to me. You're absolutely right. The cartoons, superheroes, and the adventure fiction you love to read would all be disgusted with you. At this very moment, Jack Reacher is curling his lip. Hawk is saying something ironic about you to Spencer, and Travis McGee thinks you're as helpless as Meyer. Okay? You're a total failure as Superman. The Saint would be ashamed of you. Parker thinks you're a pussy. Accept that. Deal with it on your own time. Right now, you're in the real world. Work the problem.
Okay. My voice sounded normal again. The rest of the room was there once more, and the universe outside. I could feel my lungs filling and emptying. What time is it, Zooty? After 9? Okay, obviously the first thing to do is... I trailed off.
Oh,
Zooty said sadly.
That's too bad.
Well, why would I memorize my son's cell phone number? Christmas and birthday calls I make on a landline. And why would a Vancouver police officer who wanted only to forget she ever knew me have given me her cell? If there was any way to look up a cell phone number, I didn't know it, and if there was, I was sure theirs would both be unlisted. Wait, Zooty had a laptop and internet. I could... Oh, damn it, that was no good either. Jesse used an email address. It was just a random string of letters and numbers to defeat spammers. Could I call some friend of Jesse's in New York and get his cell number from them? Not for hours, even if I could think of one. It was after 1 a.m. there now. Could I call the Vancouver cops and try to use my newspaper credentials to con Nika's cell number out of them? I remembered how much fun I'd had a few years ago just trying to get the cops to tell me over the phone where I could find police headquarters. I could call my own house. If Jesse were within earshot, heard my voice on the answering machine, maybe I could get him to come inside and pick up the phone. Or maybe Agent Pitt would hear me and I'd have given him a phone number traceable back to... Zooty, do you even have a phone out here? No landline, obviously, and where the hell would be his cell phone relay? Whatever, he'd stand out like a sore thumb, a single-number cell zone like that. He pointed across the room to his laptop.
VOIP. Untraceable.
I sighed. Boy, that would be useful if I could just think of somebody to call. But I can't think of anyone on Heron who'd take a message to a stranger hiding in my neighbor's barn without asking questions. At least... no one I'd feel right sending out in the dark with Agent Pitt on the loose. Of the two RCMP on the island, the good one has slammed car doors shut on his own head 3 times just that I know of.
It's a perfect... I saw his face, broke off, took a deep breath. You're right.
Work the problem.
Okay. Step one, define parameters. I say Pitt won't make a move until at least 1 a.m. He almost has to have taken a room in one of the B&Bs down in the cove, and that's the one part of the rock where there are people walking around on sidewalks under streetlights noticing one another until midnight or so most nights. So I've got a window of 4 hours to get my ass back to my place, get Jesse clear, grab that damn PowerBook 1400 and physically destroy its internal drive, then hook up with Nika and find us all a safe house for the night. Tomorrow we can cook up a way to get him out here and in your range so you can figure out how to neutralize him. Zooty, tell me you got a boat stashed, something fast and powerful that a child could operate, fully fueled and ready to go. He hesitated.
Well, I've got a boat.
Just from the way he said it, my heart started sinking. Show me. We went outside. The rain had gone, at least for now, and there was a steady, warm breeze. Night had fallen. I followed Zooty's pale form through the darkness, and whenever I grew uncertain of my next move, he knew it and called back directions. Before long, we came to a sort of seaside grotto, like a cave open on three sides, easily accessible but concealed from the air. The boat was a two-man kayak. I looked around frantically without finding anything with an outboard or fuel cans for one.
Shit, Zooty. Engines make noise, draw attention. I don't ever need to go anywhere farther or faster than I can paddle. You can't sink one of those.
Just looking at the thing made me tired. I understood perfectly now why he was so incredibly fit for our age. He had to be. Well, it was a two-holer, at least.
Can you paddle us to Heron Island?
At this time of night? No, sorry. Too many people awake. No place I know to land where I wouldn't have to come in range of way too many.
I suppressed a groan, a pointless gesture with him.
I really am sorry, Russell, but you'll be fine. You've got 4 hours to do a little over an hour's worth of paddling. It won't be anywhere near as hard as rowing that big Zodiac you arrived in, and you'll make much better time, and I think the rain will hold off long enough. Keep it slow and steady, and you'll be fine. You can afford to stop and rest whenever you need to. The current will be with you, going the other way. The wind direction could be better, but it could be worse, too. Heron's right next door. Try a trip to the mainland sometime. Now that's a workout.
I told myself he was right. Heron was a far larger navigational target than Coveney had been. Easier to see, easier to hit. I could do this.
Okay, Hal.
Launch straight out and paddle like mad. It'll be nuts for a while, and then all of a sudden you'll catch a current. It'll let go of you a couple of hundred meters out. When it does, head north. That way. As soon as you're far enough around to see Heron, make straight for it.
I knew if I hesitated, I'd never go. Without even looking ahead, I jumped into the rear hole of the silly little thing, figured out how to sit, figured out how the paddle wanted to be held, got Zooty to show me how to attach a leash like a telephone cord to it so I couldn't lose it. It was wet in there, but not too bad. Zooty showed me where water, flashlight, first aid kit, and flares were stashed, and shoved me off. He was right. For the first little while, it was nuts. Water changed direction and speed unpredictably, spray kept lashing in my face. The actions I took sometimes seemed to have no effect at all, and other times seemed to have more than I'd expected. More than once I glanced off rock, either seen or unseen, and was glad I was in a kayak instead of a big rubber donut. And then, all at once, I felt that current Zooty had spoken of take hold of me and start rushing me out into deep water. My speed increased to the point where I stopped using the paddles to make sure I wouldn't lose them. Distance started to open up between me and the island behind me. I grinned, starting to enjoy myself. I let the magic carpet carry me until I felt it losing steam, and then I put my paddles back in the water and started heading north. It was enormously easier than rowing the damn Zodiac had been. I glanced back at the shore and saw Zooty, a pale smudge against the blackness. I waved, but did not see him wave back. I must be invisible to him, and out of telepathy range, too. I resumed rowing, chose a slow, steady pace I knew I'd be able to keep up, and felt my right lung let go. Spontaneous pneumothorax is not the scariest thing that's ever happened to me, not even the very first one when I was 15. The scariest so far was hearing Susan's diagnosis and prognosis. Next scariest would probably be the time centuries before that, when I watched an angry biker put two slugs through the rear window of my car and then bring the Luger around until it was aimed right between my eyes. I can still remember his.
But it's up in that range. Even now, despite all the years of weary familiarity, despite the fact that it had been years since the last really bad one, maybe partly because of how long it had been, the surgery that had changed my lung collapses from life-threatening to highly unpleasant had been done more than 30 years ago, without warranty or expiry date, in a charity ward. But there isn't even that much rationality to it. Maybe it's just the intimacy of the pain. Inside your own personal chest, you feel a giant hand clamp down on one of your lungs and start to squeeze, and it might as well be squeezing your adrenal glands. A state of panic is not improved by entering it with a halved air supply. Every breath reinforces the fear, and even the fear was less powerful than the dismay I felt.
God damn it, I did not have fucking time for this now. My son was in serious danger. My friends were in serious danger. I was in serious danger. This was not the time to be laid up in bed for a few days, living on tea and packaged food and watching all 7 seasons of The West Wing on DVD again. I had to undo my own monstrous stupidity, or at least warn Jesse and Nika of it. I had to. Fuck this stupid long collapse. I didn't have time for it. It was just going to have to wait. I put the paddle back into the water and took another stroke. The pain became more powerful than the fear and the dismay put together. I tried to scream, but lacked the air, and so produced instead a sound remarkably like the one the cartoon animal makes when it realizes it has overrun the edge of the cliff. But I didn't need air to scream with my mind. Just as I had on the way in to Coveney Island, I found myself mentally shrieking, "Help me, Zooty!" on my way out. And with even less optimism. In the first place, this time I knew for a fact I was outside his range, and in the second place, what the hell could he possibly do if he did hear me? I was in his only boat. And what the hell difference did it make? If he could reach me on a jet ski, he'd forgotten to mention, say, the best he could do is bring me back to his bat cave and give me a comfy place to lie down while everything I cared about went to shit outside. It took me that long to realize what a comparatively happy outcome that would have been. At best, I was liable to get that place to lie down a minimum of 12 hours from now aboard some Coast Guard rescue vessel, and I doubted it would be comfy. But it seemed at least as likely that I would be getting my rest much sooner than that at a B&B run by Davy Jones. I resumed screaming telepathically. Maybe Zooty just hadn't felt like waving back. Maybe he had a windsurfing board stashed somewhere. In my head, I bellowed, roared, hollered, whooped, hooted, and produced a better thumb and two-finger bus driver's whistle than I actually could aloud. Meanwhile, my body was busy, mindlessly seeking relief, indifferent to any but the most immediate consequences. When you feel the buildup of pressure in half your chest, it means air and blood and other body fluids are moving to a place they're not supposed to be. It becomes essential to be lying down flat on your back on something as soft and supportive as possible with your head slightly elevated. Only then can you begin to accurately evaluate both the extent and the rate of that pressure buildup, which will tell you how much trouble you're in. The best I could manage in that damn kayak was to bring my arms inside and put them down at my sides and try to breathe as shallowly as possible. The paddle was sensibly enough attached to the hull with a leash, so I decided to just let it drift. But its random collisions with the kayak became unbearably irritating. I retrieved it with my left hand and tried to stuff it into the forward passenger compartment, but there was a cover I'd have needed both hands to unzip. I had to stow it in my own cocoon, where there was just barely room for it. Then my mind and my body had both done everything they could, everything there was for them to do, and sorrow smashed me flat. The only thing you can do to try to ease grief that profound is to burst into tears, and even that small consolation was denied me. I had not cried for longer than 10 seconds at a time in over 30 years. It just hurt too much. I cut it off in the first second or two now, from long habit. I concentrated on slowing my breathing then and listening very hard to my lung. After an eternity or two, I began to feel reassured that it was not getting worse. The pressure did not appear to grow or migrate. I could take in well over half a breath before the pain clamped down. Nothing about pneumothorax is certain, but this seemed to be one of the minor ones. Just bad enough to make paddling unthinkable. What I did next embarrasses me a little. It used to drive Susan crazy when she was alive. But if you can't even ease your unbearable grief by sobbing, the only thing left to do is convert it into anger. And anger has to have a target, and a random and indifferent universe is just not a very satisfying enemy. And so I found myself, not for the first time, viciously and bitterly cursing a god I have not believed in since childhood.
It always feels wrong, even at the time, exactly as hypocritical as suddenly finding faith in a foxhole. But hey, it's the only consolation God has left me, so give me a break, okay? Since I didn't do it out loud, I wasn't even wasting my breath. There could be a God, and if so, somebody ought to be cursing her. An intelligent designer of this mess would have to be a sadist with an infantile sense of humor. I won't attempt to reproduce any of my rhapsody of rage, but I put my heart into it and outdid myself. I mean, I cut the Almighty a new one. You tell me, what more perfectly, hilariously ironic response could I have hoped to receive to my cursing than a straight-up miracle?
Cut it out!
Those had been the very first words Zudi had spoken to me after the 30-year hiatus in our friendship. Exactly. But they weren't coming from my memory. They were coming from about 100 meters to my left.
Just don't let it happen again, I said to my imaginary god and stopped believing in him again.
And then I started trying to make myself tranquil, out of politeness to my telepathic friend who had risked death to save my life, and not for the first time. By the time he reached the kayak, I was as calm as I could manage, and he knew how grateful I was.
"Let me worry about getting us ashore," was the first thing he said when he could spare breath for talking.
"Fine," I said with relief, for the problem appeared insoluble to me. So did another, more pressing one.
"How are you going to—" He unzipped the cover on the forward seat.
"Brace yourself," he said,
and I did. "And if I told you what I think I saw, you wouldn't believe me, and I wouldn't blame you because I don't believe it myself. So all I'm going to say is that one minute he was in the water, and the next minute he was in the kayak. Without, as I'd been expecting, having to roll it over and dunk me. We didn't even rock hard or for long.
"Here,"
he said, and handed me back the wet flotation cushion he'd just sat on. I tucked it between me and my seat back, and it helped. We sat there together like that without speaking for a while until he got his wind back, him breathing big and fast, me breathing small and slow, rocking on the waves together. Once again I was impressed by his physical conditioning. His upper arms were incredible. He must have swum like a dolphin to catch me. You couldn't get arms like that just rowing back and forth from Coveney to the mainland, not unless you did nothing else with your time, which would draw too much attention and get you photographed or videoed by too many tourists on passing ferries or sailboats, so he must have...
"That's right,"
he said over his shoulder.
"I've never gone as far as George Dyson has, but at least once I paddled so far north I was the only living thing bigger than a bacterium."
Sure, it made sense. I could see him doing it. For the exercise. For the trip itself. For the solitude so precious to him.
"And for penance, yes,"
he said.
"It nearly killed me."
"Glad to hear it."
"What do you mean you're glad to hear it?"
"In the 4 years since we saw each other last, Zudi, I must have rented a boat and come out here half a dozen times." "Okay, goddammit, 4 times. And each time I pooted round and round your stupid island, shouting at the top of my mind for hours. And it wasn't so much that no answer ever came back as that I never once got a sense that anybody was even home, listening to me, choosing to ignore me. It was like yelling down a well. I was really afraid you were dead, you big dumb son of a—"
"I'm sorry, I should have left word that I—"
"You should have left some fucking word, Arctic Circle excursion or not. I've been figuring maybe I sent you off to your cave to snuff yourself because I bungled the job you gave me so badly that you had to—"
"Chill."
The incongruity of the word coming from him helped me do so.
"We could swap guilts later, okay? Right now there's paddling to do."
"And roger that. Speaking of chilling, you're starting to shiver, you know."
"I know."
He reached down into his own body cast, fumbled around, came up with a hoodie sweatshirt, and put it on.
"If you raise that seat cushion a little higher, it'll still provide as much support, and you'll be able to lean your head back against it."
"By God, you're right. Thanks, Zudi. You know, this is the first time I've ever had a collapse lung and been able to have a conversation with someone without sounding like the kid in the wheelchair and Malcolm in the Middle."
"Stevie Carnarvon, let me know if the pain starts to get any worse."
He began to paddle, and then he paddled, and then he paddled, and we were gone, gone, gone like a cool breeze. At first I divided my attention between monitoring my right thorax and trying to think my way out of the hole I'd put us all into. But even with a partial lung collapse and a crisis ahead, skating on black glass through a warm, star-spattered night on a kayak being paddled by a man with arms like the mighty Thor is a magical experience. Distracting, calming, soon hypnotic. I knew I had some hard thinking to do. But not just yet. These might be the best moments left in my life. The sun was all the way down now, and the moon wouldn't be up for hours yet. But the skies had cleared for the moment, and there sure were a lot of stars up there. Zudi found his rhythm and settled into it, cutting a gigantic silver V through the black water, riding the waves with the effortless ease of a veteran subway strap hanger, or, I suppose, a surfer. I entered a mental state deeper than meditation generally took me, but short of a trance. I remained alert and aware of my surroundings and my situation and my predicament. I just stopped having any opinions at all about them for a while.
Thus ends Chapter 11 of Very Hard Choices by Spider Robinson and Spider on the Web, number 46. For information on where and how to get tickets to Crosby, Stills, and Nash, go to www.crosbystillsnash.com. They're passing through Washington State and then California in the next week or two. I thank you all very kindly for your subscriptions, your donations, your gifts of poultry or other livestock, or just a gift of an hour of your attention. I do appreciate it. I'm going to play you out with a special treat for Beatle fans, what is probably the rarest Beatle-related track in existence. Exactly one copy of the following single was ever pressed and was given as a birthday gift to Maureen Starkey on the occasion of her 22nd birthday, when she was still married to Ringo Starr. The track features exactly two artists, a pianist named Sammy Kahn, and a vocalist whose name I misremember, but whom Maureen had publicly identified as her favorite singer. He rewrote the lyrics to this tune specifically in her honor as his way of thanking her. Here's a lovely, heartfelt tribute to Maureen Cox Starkey Tigrett, who left the party on December 30th, 1994. The lady is a champ.
There's no one like her, but no one at all. And as for charm, hers is like wall to wall. She married Ringo, and she could have had Paul. That's why the lady is a champ. Creates excitement whenever it's dull. She just appears, and there goes the lull. She merely smiles, and you're out of your skull. That's why the lady is a champ. The folks who do and don't meditate agree she's great. They mean Maureen. I've got more lyrics right after this vamp, because the lady is a champ. Though we've not met, I'm convinced she's a gem. I'm just SS, but to me, she's Big M. Mainly because she prefers me to them. That's why the lady is a champ. I have lots of fans, well, at least one or two. But Peter Brown called me to tell me it's true. She sleeps with Ringo, but she thinks of you. That's why the lady is a champ. But I can boast as much as I please. The fact is that she's his wife, but that's life. But it's her day, so I whistle and stamp, because the lady, the charming lady, Mr. Ringo's lady, is a champ.